Coming to you from Toronto, Canada, this is Classic Camera Revival. If you don't have gear acquisition syndrome now, you certainly will after listening to this show.
Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of Classic Camera Revival for April 2015, and today we're going to be talking about an interesting film format that has sort of died out in the film industry, but has been maintained in the digital side of photography, and that's APS, or the Advanced Photo System. Now, APS was introduced by the major photographic companies, Kodak, Canon, Nikon, Minolta, and even Agfa and Fuji jumped on board with this format. And as I said before, it's maintained in the digital world. You often seen, especially on my nice brand new Sony A6000, it actually says right on it, APS-C. And that's the size of the image sensor, which is based on the classic format of APS. So today we have a handful of interesting cameras, including the three major SLR versions of the APS system, along with one interesting point and shoot. So we're first going to take it all the way over to Oakville, and we're going to discuss the Nikon Pronia and the Minolta Vectis, and along with what it's like to process APS film in the lab for someone who is just joining a film lab that already has APS sensors, APS processors in it. Hey everybody, this is Alex Lokes, and we are doing something a little different for April. We are here in Oakville talking with my good friend, brother in arms, and we'll get to that reason in July, James McFarlane.
Hello, photo people. How are you today?
Okay, so now we have a couple of very interesting APS cameras here on the table. We have the Nikon Pronia and my personal favorite, the Minolta Vectis. So, James, all up to you.
Well, I'm going to take this one piece at a time. First of all, I'd like to compare the two Nikon APS cameras that came out. First one I have in my hand is the first one that I saw. It's a little underwhelming. It's a Nikon Pronia S. It's an APS camera that does basically your green box auto mode and all your other standard portrait mode, landscape mode, macro mode, night mode, as well as your aperture modes and a program mode. No manual. There are no manual overrides on this camera. There are very few things you can do with it. The one good thing about it is that it's fairly small, nondescript. It's a nice, sleek little package. That's about all the nice things I have to say about the Pronia S. On this camera, it came stock with a 30-60mm f4-5.6 lens. It's an alright lens, but one of the things that I think Nikon made a mistake with when they were making their APS cameras was they came up with an APS proprietary mount for their lenses. So you can't put these lenses on any other Nikon camera, and no other standard Nikon lenses are going to fit on this one.
Oh, jeez.
So they kind of missed the boat there. One of the things I thought Canon did very well with their camera was that you could put any of the EF lenses onto that body. So you effectively could use the whole pool of lenses.
Yep.
Now, I'm going to have to eat those words with the next camera that I'm holding, which is the far superior Pronia 600i. This one, while still having the drawback that it only works with the Nikon APS series of lenses, will have every other feature you can look for in a camera. It's really, really cool. It starts off with one major mode switch on the top, which goes from basic, where it's the same as your green box auto, where the camera does everything, to advanced. And when you're on advanced, you can fire this thing in a fully manual mode. You can put it in an aperture mode. You can change your shutter sinks. You can do all kinds of things with this camera that effectively make it the best camera I've seen for the APS series.
Yeah, that thing looks like it's a digital camera. It looks like that's what they base the 5000 and the 3200s on. Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Well, considering that APS as a film format was considered to be the proving ground for an APS-C sized digital sensor.
Yes.
There's really no surprise that this camera in form factor looks very similar to any DSLR that you'd see. Yeah. And the other thing about it is that while it is in the form factor very similar to any Nikon DSLR, it is also much thicker than you would imagine for something that this size. It's a little chunky. It was a little bulky. Okay. Yeah. But it still works well. The only other complaint I have about this camera is that it has one of the common early 90s Nikon drawbacks, and that is the material they use for the hand grip. If you can feel that there. After a couple of years of age, it gets sticky.
Oh, gosh.
And it's bad on the hands. It's even worse if you're putting it up to your eye when the eyepiece is sticky around. But that's not a major indictment of Nikon at this point. They made a camera out of this material, and it worked just fine for a number of years. And at this point, it doesn't really owe us anything. That's rubber. There's rubber coating on it.
Exactly. Now, the one that I'm really interested in are these Minolta Vectuses. Mm-hmm. This is a slick package.
The Vectuses, or the Vecti, as I call them, come in a variety of different cameras. I'm going to start off briefly touching on the two lower-end models, and then we're going to go into the big one.
Right.
The lowest-end model of the Vectus series is the Minolta Vectus 300.
Okay.
It's a very simple...
It's a point-and-shoot.
Yeah, it's a point-and-shoot. Basically, the only adjustment you get to put on this is the standard APS masking on it, that way you can set it to shoot in panorama, full-frame, or...
High def.
C. Classic, yes, yeah.
Yeah.
I only ever use a regular one and the panorama one. Yep. One of the odd things about this size is that its native resolution size on the negative is 4x7. It doesn't readily fit in, if you want to put your whole image in the print, it doesn't readily fit in a regular album insert page.
Nice.
So it's a bit odd.
Weird.
But it's a nice big size. The next step up from this one is the Minolta Vectus 40, which is a weatherproofed camera. Both of these, by the way, have the date stamping ability on it. And the great thing about the APS system is that it didn't just put the date right over your image like most other date backs, but it actually puts it along with other crucial information in the margin.
Okay.
Along the side of the frame.
So does it include stuff like shutter speed and aperture?
It can on some of the more high-end cameras.
Okay,
not on the small ones. Now, this one has a 30-120 macro lens. And it's like a point-and-shoot, but it's an upgraded point-and-shoot. It's a little bit larger in the hand.
It's your uncle's camera.
Yeah, it's nice, but it's basically everyone's uncle's camera.
Yeah. Now, these are the ones that I really like.
Yes.
The first thing I thought when I saw these, the Vectus SLRs, is... Oh, it looks like an Olympus pen, because it has the viewfinder on the side, but don't let that fool you, this is an SLR.
Mm-hmm. It's got a classic rangefinder, viewfinder to the left kind of look to the back of the camera. Now, these particular cameras is very interesting. These came as a loan to use for this segment from Joan at Burlington Camera.
We'll be hearing from Joan later on.
And she... loves Minolta. She loved the Vectus series. She bought up a bunch of stuff when this was new. And one day, because she works very closely with a lot of the people at Minolta, one day she got a phone call from the shipping department saying, this is discontinued. We're going to be discarding this stuff. Do you want it? So they basically drove up a box load of Minolta Vectus stuff. So she has everything for this kit. I'm just going to list off the stuff that it has. She has four bodies. On one of the bodies, she has the battery grip for lenses. It comes with a 28-56, 4-5.6. It comes with a 25-150, 4-5-6.3. It comes with a 22-80, 4-5.6. On the cameras right now, there are two other lenses, but I just want to note, on those three lenses, you're going to notice that they all start fairly wide at about the same degree. So all of these, none of these kind of leapfrog each other in terms of range. They all start in the 20s and go to varying degrees of zoom. So there was very much a feeling with these lenses that you picked the one that you thought would do everything you needed and that you just left the house with one lens.
Yeah.
The other two lenses that come with it are a classic 50. A 50mm prime is a classic camera lens on any camera. This one, a little odd though, its minimum aperture is 3.5.
Okay.
So it's a little odd.
I've seen some 3.5s. I have a 35mm 3.5 for my Pentax 645.
Also, this lens throws me off because it's a good 3.5 inches, let's call it 3 inches deep, the lens. But when you look, take the lens cap off and you look down the barrel of the camera, you can see the actual front element of the lens is a good
really
2.5 inches inside the lens barrel. So this is essentially just a large lens hood they've built on there. Just a large form factor. This is the kind of lens that, if it were made today, would be part of this popular pancake lens trend.
Yes.
This would be a very flat lens on the front of this camera.
Yeah.
The other lens that is included in this system is the 400 reflex mirror lens.
Oh.
Now, I don't know if you've discussed mirror lenses in any other segments.
No.
But the mirror lens is a different way of achieving extreme telephoto. Instead of having a lot of glass and a lot of length, you use mirrors to reflect the light back and forth inside the lens, so you can effectively get a long lens package in a short lens form factor. There are benefits to mirror lenses, one of them being that you don't have a lot of chromatic and spherical aberrations that you would get in a glass lens, and another one is that it's smaller and lighter and generally a bit cheaper. But one of the drawbacks to the mirror lenses is that
softer image.
It's a softer image. It's going to be softer in sharpness and softer in contrast. And another major drawback for a lot of people would be that this is a fixed aperture lens. There is no aperture inside of a mirror lens. This one is stuck at f/8 all the time.
Oh. So you really got to watch yourself.
Yeah, you can't really do much with it.
No. Now, one interesting thing, the one camera here has a roll cage on it.
Yes, that's the other interesting part. It's got a hand grip, and it's got an all metal and rubber roll cage that runs around the outside for the very serious APS photographer.
Absolutely. Damn.
Now, on these cameras, you're, again, going to have all your modes. You're going to have a program mode. You're going to have a manual mode, as well as a variety of automatic modes.
Nice.
And Nikon and Canon high-end DSLR users will appreciate the fact that it's got a scroll wheel on the back.
Command dial.
A command dial for going back and forth between your settings.
Oh, very cool.
Now, one thing I've always liked about the APS series, and something I enjoyed getting back into again when I was playing with these cameras, testing them for technical purposes, I got to actually use some of the features that I like on the actual film rolls, where you can see in the 1, 2, 3, 4, I'm sure you're going to cover this, the 1, 2, 3, 4 on the bottom of the film cartridge, 1 being unshot, 2 being partially shot, 3 being fully shot but not processed, and 4 being processed and ready for printing.
Yeah.
2 is what's always interested me the most, where you can stop mid-roll, rewind, eject it, put it into another camera, put it back in the same camera, and the camera remembers. It'll go right back to where it was. So that was a great value to me when I was testing this, because like we know, there is no new APS film available. You can only find cold-stored and worse-stored APS film is long expired. So I was worried about, in my testing, there being a discrepancy between one roll on one camera and another roll on another camera. I was able to stop and effectively use the same roll of film in each one of these cameras to test it out.
There we go. How about that? So yeah, we'll have some images from these cameras up on the show notes. James here is an employee of Burlington Camera, which we have mentioned on the show before. So let's hear from Joan, who's one of the owners of Burlington Camera.
Hey everybody, this is Alex Lokes, and I'm here at my favorite camera store in all of Ontario, Burlington Camera, and I'm here with one of the co-owners, Joan. Joan has agreed to sit down and give us a bit of an interview. How are you doing today, Joan?
I'm doing okay.
Fantastic. So tell me a little bit about the store. What's the history of it?
Back in 1958, my mom and dad, Jack and Gladys Gibson, they opened up a part of our house that used to be on the property, and they began to sell cameras and do photo finishing and stuff like that. And we eventually took over the whole house with the store. We moved out of the house because we lived there as a family.
Okay.
And it became our full shop. And then in 1977, we switched over to a new building behind that we had built. We knocked off the back room of the house and began the building back there. And then when we finished the building, we demolished the house and paved over it.
Oh, so the house we're in right, the building we're in right now, was the one that was built in the 70s.
Yeah, we built it in 77. We did a little bit of an addition onto the building in 1992, and it's as it is in 1992 with some inner reconstruction for a dark room we had for a short period of time.
Okay.
Whatever else, yeah.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah.
So you got into photography because your family was into photography.
I was born into it.
You were born into it. So what have you done with photography?
I've always done photography. When the rule in the family was when you were 10 years old, you were allowed to have your first camera. So I got my first camera when I was 10. And I have just progressed since then. As far as photography goes, I did commercial photography for a period of time when I was home with my children. I took a little bit of a sabbatical to be home when my kids were young.
Okay.
And so I did all of our black and white developing and printing. And I did weddings and I did all kinds of things.
Oh,
and,
very
and the photography
cool.
end of things. I came back into the business when my children were in school full time.
Okay.
Yep.
So you ended up taking over the business from...
Okay, so in 1977, my father retired. My older two brothers purchased the business from my father and
okay.
my mother. And then in 7 years ago, whenever that was, my brother, who's closer in age to me, myself and my niece, we purchased the business from my oldest two brothers.
Okay.
And then my niece has gone on to other things. And
right.
So Richard, he's 6.5 years older than me. Richard and myself, we are the owners of the present Burlington Camera.
Oh, yes. Very cool. Very cool. Yeah, no. Joan has always made me feel welcome ever since I first started coming in here. A coworker of mine sent me in because she knew Don.
My oldest brother.
Yes. when I picked up my first film camera, she went, oh, if you're ever having any problems with it, just take it to Don at Burlington Camera. So... what's next for Burlington Camera?
Well, we've kind of always been into film photography. We're into digital as well.
Mm-hmm.
But we've never abandoned film, which is kind of what you're into and your cohorts.
Yeah.
We're finding quite a resurgence with silver halide technology.
Yeah.
And so we continue on. We do a lot of used equipment. You noticed the sign on the way in. It said we buy and sell used equipment.
Yep.
And yes, we do. We've got vintage cameras that are just pretty to look at.
Yeah.
We've got vintage cameras that are fully working if you want to go that way. And then we do the newest digital cameras as well.
Fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, if you're in the area, definitely come down Guelph Line and New Street in Burlington, Ontario. Check out Burlington Camera. Joan, thank you very much for taking some time to sit down with us, and we wish you the best.
Well, thank you, Alex.
Okay. So yeah, it is truly it is my favorite camera store in the area. Now, one thing that APS really brought about was the fact that a lot of camera shops and labs disliked it when it came out because they had to upgrade all their mini lab equipment. But for someone who is coming into this lab to do processing, APS is actually really easy. James here, as I mentioned before, is an employee and is the lab monkey for them.
That's what I do.
So describe to us what it's like to process this APS film.
What you're going to see along with the show notes on this episode, we're going to have some links to some videos on YouTube. I'm actually going to record the whole process of what's called carding, by using air quotes that you can't see, carding film to go into a C41 processing machine. Now, with with regular 35mm film, you need to use a film picker, pull out the tab, tape it to a card, load the card into the machine, hang the card when it's out, cut it, scan it, sleeve it. It's a whole process, and it's very hands-on. You always need to wear gloves. You don't want to get fingerprints all over the nags, particularly for client work. And it's an easy enough system to use once you've done it and once you know how to do it. And that's why I was just floored when my boss showed me the first time how to use the APS way of doing things, and it was so much easier. There are machines for all of these things. There's a machine that takes the undeveloped film in the dark, transports it out of the cassette into an intermediate cassette that then goes over to the carding station. At the carding station, rather than physically cutting the film and splicing tape, attaching it to a card, there's a card for that. It's designed to simply stick right around, and it hooks right on. And this is going to make much more sense when you see the video. And another thing that's a common staple of 35mm processing is what's known as a twin check. A twin check is a little sticker that's got four numbers on it, and there are two stickers. One sticker for the film, and one sticker for the envelope. You twin check the film to make sure that the right film is going back to the right customer. Because once it's out of the machine, with no numbers on it, you have no idea, short of asking someone, what did you have on that roll of film? Oh, this one's yours! So you really need to have that there. APS, it's covered. When it comes out of the factory, it's got a twin check already digitally burned into the negative.
Oh, nice.
You don't need to twin check it. You don't need to cut it. You don't need to worry about exposing it when you're pulling it out of the canister. And it just goes right into the machine. When it comes out, this is the best part, there's another machine that simultaneously spools the processed film back inside the cassette, as well as advancing to the number 4 on the bottom of the cassette.
Very nice.
So it's all done with machines. It's all done very quickly and very easily. And even the scanning for this is great, because you just load the scanner, the cassette, into a specialized port on the front of the Noritsu scanner. That's what we use in our workflow.
Yep.
And it just takes it away and does the whole thing. And when it's done, it winds it right back inside the cartridge, which is great for storage. It's a little bit bulky if you want to store it with your prints.
Yeah.
But otherwise, it keeps them dust-free, and it keeps them out of the light, and it's so that they won't fade. It's a very robust system, which is why I was when I saw it, I was surprised. So many people had said to me so many times how awful an API system was to labs and to dealers, and how they hated working with this stuff. I didn't get it.
That's really fantastic. Thank you very much for sharing this, and thank you very much to Joan for loaning us all this great equipment.
One other thing?
Yes.
Joan is looking forward to the day, and if you're out there and you have the technology, there is a market for this. She wants to see adapters for these Vectis lenses. Joan likes to shoot on a Sony Alpha mirrorless camera, and she has adapters for all the legacy lenses, so she can put any lens on her camera. She would kill to use one of these on her Sony mirrorless. So if you've got something out there, short of a 3D printer, that you can make an adapter for a Vectis lens, there is a market for that.
Absolutely, absolutely. So yes, James will be back for our July episode. So if you really enjoyed that, I know I sure did. I didn't realize that Minolta even made a Vectis SLR, or that it looked so damn good. Anyways, we'll bring it back to Toronto. All right, catch you guys later. And hey, we're back here in Toronto, and now we're going to turn it over to Donna, who's going to be talking about the Canon version of the APS SLR.
Today I'll be talking about the EOS IX Lite. It's also the IX7. It was made in 1998. Now, I absolutely love this camera. It is a very light, compact camera. It's great for long trips because it's not heavy. What I absolutely love about this camera, though, is that it takes APS film. It's a great system that lets you change rolls in midstream, literally. What I also like about the APS film is that you can get index print sheets, which is very cool for just picking prints that you want to get developed instead of having to print the whole entire roll. The EOS IX Lite has automatic adjustment for close-ups, portraits, landscapes, action scenes, as well as night shots. It also has a built-in high-performance 3-point autofocus system, as well as a built-in flash that activates automatically, or you can also shut it off manually. Another thing I like about this camera is that it also accepts all Canon EF lenses. It's a great little camera. Again, very light, very good to take around for long trips, and overall is just very great camera.
Now, I'm looking at this this camera here, and it definitely does not have an EFF lens on it. It looks like it's off of an enlarger. Mike, explain this lens.
So what I've done here is I've taken an enlarger lens, the little Peterson 50mm f4.5. Yeah, I know. It sounds absolutely nuts. And, well, here's the thing. I've actually taken it from an old EFS lens, an old broken EFS lens, so I didn't mangle anything new, took the mount off, and I cut off the flange that prevents it from being mounted to EF mount cameras. As soon as I cut off that flange, which is also known as modifying, I can now mount it to any EF camera. And, well, funny thing is the EOS IX Lite is an EF mount camera, which means any EF lens mounts to it, but not the EFS. change that flange, get rid of that flange, and now you can mount EFS lenses with full coverage. Well, as Alex mentioned at the beginning of the segment, APS is still the crop sensor. Well, the film is what introduced the crop sensor. So we've got the APS-C, APS-H, and APS-P, which is just classic, high def, and panoramic. And you get full coverage at every focal length using that kind of...
But how do you focus that? There, I mean, with an enlarger lens, you're dependent on your enlarger to actually focus it. You don't have those bellows on your camera.
Well, that's just it. Is this one? No, you technically speaking can't focus. Right now, as soon as I screw the lens on, it's set to the point where it's actually focused beyond infinity. So John's got a great little blurb that he likes to say.
Yes, it's the Buzz Lightyear lens because it focuses to infinity and beyond.
Yeah, literally, it focuses beyond infinity, but stop down the lens and suddenly it becomes like a box camera. You're just point, shoot, done. But of course, you're focusing from 8 feet and, well, I don't think you quite get infinity, but it's pretty darn close.
Can I say, isn't photography cool? We can actually talk about a concept like focusing past infinity and it makes sense. That just blows my mind.
Now, another little quick thing that I want to talk about with APS film and all the fun stuff before it gets dragged on too far is the fact that Kodak had introduced, as Alex mentioned, the APS format. But the one thing that they introduced also was a camera that both came with a film shutter door and a sensor. And they called it the APS preview camera, or the Advantix preview camera. Now, the whole thing, what that allowed you to do was take the photo and be able to see if you got the photo or not. Now, of course, that led eventually to chimping, which is very common in today's standards. You take a photo on your DSLR or your point and shoot or your phone, and you're like, oh, did I get it? No, I didn't, because it's blurry. Let's try it again, or delete it. Well, I'm pretty sure it didn't allow you to delete the photo. You would take the shot, see if you got it or not. If not, take it again and keep trying until you got it. So it was a really, really interesting concept. Obviously, that concept really caught on well because you can see it on every single digital camera today. So that's my little blurb on APS film and on a really interesting concept that Kodak brought out that really, really, really caught on.
Very cool. All right. Now, since we've dealt with this interesting little format that sadly is no longer around. I mean, it's digital really brought about the death of APS because it came out shortly thereafter. And the fact that a lot of camera stores didn't want to promote it because it meant they had to retool their entire mini lab. So let's bring it back down into the dark room. And now in the past several episodes, we've talked about black and white film developing chemistry. We've talked about setting up your home dark room. And we've talked about developing film at home. Now we need something to actually print the photos on. So we're going to have an interesting discussion here about paper and the different types available. Now, black and white paper comes in two flavors. There's resin coat, which uses almost a plastic resin to coat on the paper to hold the emulsion. And then there's fiber-based one, which is silver nitrate soaked fibers. So now I mostly have experience with the Ilford line of things. Now there's a lot more out there, so we're going to skip over Ilford. They got a lot of press. They're head over heels for film and analog photography, and they have great lines of paper out there. But let's get into some of the stranger ones that are still available.
Agfa, Rollei, Adox,
Kentmere makes paper.
Foma.
Foma?
Yep, Foma. Photochemica, I believe, still makes. At least I think so. I have seen some sites selling Photochemica. And Oriental. I've heard really, really good things about Oriental paper.
But I wonder if their quality control is better for their paper than it is for their film.
That's,
you would know about that, Mike.
Yeah, I've had really, really bad experience with the Shanghai film. I got some in 4x5. Now, a lot of people love the film. My first experience with it was not really good. So I probably not the best person to talk about it with real high praise. But I'll give it one thing: tonality, beautiful, absolutely beautiful.
So what do you look for in a paper?
Well, for me, and I will, I'll be honest, I have a bias towards fiber-based paper. As we record this, I'm still working on getting my my show prints ready. And I find for permanence, fiber-based, properly handled, properly processed, will tend to last longer than a resin-coated RC print. I'll just say RC. My favorite finish on fiber base is what's called glossy dried matte. Mm-hmm. So I buy, you know, the box of paper will say glossy, but in the old days, to get a glossy finish, what people would have to do is use what's called a ferrotype drying machine, which is basically a mirror finish heater. You would put the print on top, like face down, onto this mirror finish, squeegee out the water, and then it would dry, and eventually it would pop off, and you get this nice mirror finish, which is sort of what like the RC glossy looks like.
Okay.
But if you don't go that route and just allow the glossy paper to dry, to air dry, you get a very nice luster, but it's not mirror like, and to me that. That is really, really my favorite kind of finish. I'm not a huge fan of the glossy look in the RC paper. It looks a bit artificial to my mind, but that's just a personal thing.
I totally agree. When I'm, and I mean, I only print on RC simply because I don't have the capabilities to make my fiber prints dry flat. And that's one of the pros of printing on RC paper. I much prefer the Ilford satin finish because it leans a little more to the glossy side of the matte finish, so it doesn't have that mirror-like quality, but it still gives incredible blacks when exposed properly.
I agree. I've been using some satin, and for one of the things I really like about satin is putting portraits on it. Absolutely stunning, stunning blacks, really, really smooth whites on it, but just the look that you get, it's phenomenal.
There is one paper I do want to mention, even though it's by Ilford, and it's the Ilford Art 300 paper, which is significant for a number of reasons. A, in a time where whenever a photographic paper is in the news, it's because it's being discontinued. A couple of years ago, maybe 3 years ago, Ilford announced this new paper, and it flew in the face of modern trends. In a day where everything seems to be about resin-coated, it was fiber-based, heavy stock, and has a beautiful what's called eggshell finish, which it's not matte, it's not glossy, it has a lovely texture. And one thing I like about the texture of this paper is that it allows me to do hand tinting. It takes the pigment in a way that that glossy fiber base won't, unless you do extensive pre-treatment. And so it was nice. Like, I think Ilford made a statement when they released this paper saying that we believe that there is a long-term future for art quality darkroom printing. So I'm hoping that some of the other paper manufacturers will take the message from Ilford and, you know, keep making the high quality fiber based prints. Because sorry, I'm on a bit of a rant here. Because I think, to me, where film photography really shines, where it shows how it's unique, it's when you actually have the print in your hands. Like a digital scanner, like a scan of an image, that's sort of the great leveler. You don't see as much difference between a digital and a film print. But if you see the actual traditional darkroom black and white print in your hand, and you look at it and it's well done, or even competently done, you look at it and say, ah, now I get it. That's why film photography still matters.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've had a few times where I've had an absolutely amazing scan from the negative, and it looks great like that. But as soon as I put it onto paper, I go, eh, meh. And it's not that great anymore. But I'm looking at this, and the one thing I really, really, really like about Ilford is their dedication to maintaining high quality black and white products, from film to chemistry and even to paper. And just looking at this print here really seals it, that when I start putting together a darkroom portfolio, it's going to be on the Art 300 paper. I'm going to spend the extra money
now. Art 300, yeah, yeah. I agree. I've used it and I really like it. John actually introduced me to it. I've done 8x10, I've done 5x7. I really, really like the Art 300 paper. Fantastic. Yeah. Obviously not for every single print.
No.
But when you get the right image on that paper, it just
Sings.
Looks yeah. Yeah, it looks so much better on that paper than any other paper out there.
Yeah. And I mean, if you're just getting started off in the darkroom, don't worry about fiber base. You can get to that later. Buy yourself a 100 sheet box of the Ilford Multigrade 4 resin coat.
Glossy is usually the least expensive.
Glossy is the least expensive, or matte. I mean, take a look at the example that they have online. Pick a finish that you really, really like. And like I said, don't cheap out. Don't buy a 25 sheet box. Buy a 100 sheet box and sit it down there and learn.
Yeah, the 25 sheet box versus the 100 sheet box. Honestly, you're not really saving anything when you consider it. It's not four times the price for the 100 sheet box. It's maybe double the price. It makes a huge, huge difference when you consider when you're first starting out. I've been there. I can honestly say you get a lot of waste. And having the 100 sheet box versus 25, it makes a world of difference. You'll see that your consistency when printing goes up with each print. It's really, really a lot of fun too. And John, I really must say, this is a fantastic print.
Oh, thank you. Now, I did say that I do prefer fiber base for the most important work. And I'll have to admit that there is a bit of bias and prejudice there, because when I first started printing, like, I'm the old dude here, when I printed back in the late 1970s, when the RC paper really started coming in, it was crap. It, like, you know, to use a technical term, it did not look very nice, and the prints did not last all that long. But for a purpose, if you wanted to print something, dry quickly, and get something ready for press, it was the perfect paper. But for anything that went on a wall, people really wanted the fiber base. And today, this is like 40 years later. I feel old. 40 years later, the RC paper has come an awful long way, and for a lot of purposes, there is absolutely nothing wrong with it.
Yeah. Now, the one company we haven't mentioned is Kodak, because Kodak sadly no longer produces paper. I managed to score myself one of the last batches of their Polymax 2.
Nice.
Paper.
I've happened to have some really, really lovely paneled wear paper. That stuff is really nice. It was actually designed specifically from Kodak to print from color neg to black and white. And one of the films that was kind of designed along with it was their BW400CN, which sadly was just recently discontinued.
But Ilford still produces one.
So yeah, but it's a clear base, so that can go onto regular paper, which is even better.
Indeed, indeed. Well, do we have anything else to talk about on the paper side of things?
Well, I did happen to get my hands on some Rollei vintage paper.
Okay.
That stuff is really, really lovely, but I must say the Adox paper that I've got my hands on, the MCP 310. Now, the MCP 310 is a glossy resin coated, but the contrast on that paper is just out of this world. The images are beautiful, just beautiful.
I'm definitely planning on, once I get back from Europe this summer, putting in an order with Freestyle and getting some FOMA paper and some ADOX paper up north of the border.
Just the one maybe last thing I'll throw in about fiber-based paper, it comes with a cost. Mm-hmm. Fiber-based paper is more expensive than the RC, all other things being equal normally. And also fiber-based, because it soaks up the chemistry, you really, really, really have to process it properly. I think we might have mentioned that on a previous episode.
Yeah.
You have to put it in hypoclear,
yep,
for 3 minutes. And then, whereas an RC paper, you can wash in 30 seconds to 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Fiber-based paper, you need to wash for at least 20 minutes. Half an hour is better in running water. And that doesn't mean 20 prints in a tray. It means that print is getting water actively running over the surface. Because if you don't do that, you know, it might not happen the week after you dry the print or even a month, but a year down the road, it's going to start to turn yellow and brown because the fixer remnants will destroy the print. And if you've given that print to someone or sold that print to someone and it starts to go bad after a year, you're not going to make them very happy.
No. Again, good lab practice and consistency is always important in producing amazing print qualities. And it's all about discipline, it's all about learning, and it's all about trying, failing, and learning from your mistakes.
One other thing, fiber-based paper, if you're just starting to use fiber and you've been using resin coated, fiber base, when it dries, it really, really curls. Yep. So be ready to, when it's dried, put it in a book, mm-hmm, and just let it sit for a while in the book and it will flatten out.
Yeah, absolutely.
No worries.
No fear. All right, well, that's about wraps it up for this show. We'll be back next month with, we're going a bit red next month, and you'll have to wait to find out what I mean by that. Have a great night, all.
Keep shooting.
Keep the film rolling.
And keep them shutters firing.